HPPodCraft.com.
I saw a month or two ago in an Italian paper that the Via Cascana, in which I once stayed, had been pulled down and that a manufactory of some sort was in process of erection on its site. There is therefore no longer any reason for refraining from writing of those things which I myself saw, or imagined I saw, in a certain room and on a certain landing of the Via in question, nor from mentioning the circumstances which followed, which may or may not, according to the opinion of the reader, throw some light on or be somehow connected with this experience. The Via Cascana was in all ways but one a perfectly delightful house, yet, if it were standing now, nothing in the world, I use the phrase in its literal sense, would induce me to set foot in it again, for I believe it to have been haunted in a very terrible and practical manner. Most ghosts, when all is said and done, do not do much harm. They may perhaps terrify, but the person whom they visit usually gets over their visitation. They may, on the other hand, be entirely friendly and beneficent. But the appearances in the Via Cascana were not beneficent, and had they made their visit in a very slightly different manner, I do not suppose I should have got over it, any more than Arthur Inglis did.
Ladies and gentlemen, you've just heard certain paragraphs from a certain story by E.F. Benson.
And that certain story is called Caterpillars.
Caterpillars. Lots of folks have suggested this one to us most recently and strengthfully. I think that's a word. Our friend Jason Thompson,
yes.
Comic artist. He adapted the Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath, which was pretty groovy. And
yeah.
You can find more of his work as well as that at Mockman.com.
And it isn't just Jason who is a fan of E.F. Benson. E.F. Benson was one of the authors mentioned in Supernatural Horror and Literature by H.P. Lovecraft, and that's why, you guessed it, we're talking about it here on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hppodcraft.com, I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey.
And our reader this week is none other than Jeff C. Carter, good friend and author. You can read Jeff's recent work in the Delta Green anthology Extraordinary Renditions.
Oh, yes.
He's also got stories in the Lovecraftian anthologies Tomorrow's Cthulhu and A Mythos Grimly. A Mythos Grimly, I know, is a book that mashes up Lovecraft and fairy tales, but when I heard the title, I kind of hoped it was about the mythos adventures of Ed Grimly.
Oh.
The Martin Short character.
Yes, I must say.
Jeff currently has a Kickstarter going with another horror author, Edward M. Ertelak. Ertelak is also in the Lovecraft biz sometimes. He's got stories in World War Cthulhu and Steampunk Cthulhu.
Right.
Lots of those anthologies, you know. By the way, I was going to ask the audience about this, Chris, because you and I have been talking about doing a book ourselves.
Right.
Maybe we would do something where we released Lovecraft stories with our notes on them.
Mm-hmm.
Or perhaps they would be original stories. Or maybe we'd make our own fake tome we talked about.
Yeah, we did talk about that as well.
We've batted around a lot of ideas, and I wonder, the most important thing is, what would people like to purchase from us were we to do a book?
Yeah, that's the kind of the most important thing, really.
So anyway, I just thought I'd float it out there. If anybody has ideas or there's something you'd like to see from Chris and I, we're definitely going to work on a book in the coming years, but any suggestions are welcome.
Right.
Anyhow, Jeff's Kickstarter is for a tabletop RPG. It's called Mecha West. It's basically steam-powered mecha, you know, giant robots.
Ah, not the holy Muslim city.
No, not Mecha that way. Mecha, M-E-C-H-A.
Ah, yes, okay.
They've got cannon-sized six-shooters, and they battle it out in the streets of an alternate weird west. So
oh,
it's the old west, but with a steampunk giant robot kind of thing.
I like that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's really groovy. We'll link out to it. Again, it's a tabletop role-playing game. Any gamers listening to the show are definitely going to want to check it out. Jeff, thank you so much for reading. So E.F. Benson, it's been a while since we talked about this author, I think.
It has been a while. We covered some E.F. Benson stories and the author himself on the show before. We did The Man Who Went Too Far, which was the one about the goat. If you remember that one?
Kind of.
There was a leisurely guy that didn't do anything. He just laid around all day.
Right. It was one of those beyond the veil kind of stories.
Right. And there was like an evil goat that was coming around causing problems. And then The Face we did as well. He was a really interesting guy.
Yeah. Was there a hoof print in the chest in The Man Who Went Too Far?
Yes, there was.
Okay. I think that's what Lovecraft liked it a lot, and he kind of cribbed that for The Unnameable. We also did Negotium Perambulans, which was E.F. Benson.
Right.
Way more Lovecrafty. Had a giant worm creature in it.
Oh, right. Yes. Okay. I remember that one. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Has actually some slight themes in common or creatures in common with the story we're about to cover.
Yeah.
But of course, E.F. Benson was also most famous for the Map and Lucia series of novels.
Right.
Which are kind of funny, snobby society in a small town books. They've been adapted a few times by the BBC, I think as recently as 2014.
Oh, whoa.
But of course, he wrote ghost stories on the side, which is what this is.
We've had haunted house stories on the show a bunch. And this month, actually, we've been kind of focusing again on haunted houses. But man, this one is really strange.
Yeah.
It starts off with our narrator. He's telling us about this place that he stayed at years ago in Italy called the Villa Cascana, and it has recently been destroyed. Wow. So he now feels that he can talk about it. Again, this is a very similar kind of theme.
By the way, there is no way the original title of the story wasn't Villa of the Caterpillar.
Oh.
Or maybe Villa Caterpillar, a thriller.
Now I just feel bad for you.
You feel bad for me? I wrote that down.
You made that joke. Sorry, dude.
Yeah, no, that's good. That's the impact I wanted. That's the effect I was trying for. When I make my jokes, I want people to feel things other than laughter.
Pity.
Pity. Pity, yeah. I'm a weird comedian.
He goes on to say that this place was great. It had a nice view, pleasant weather, nice hosts.
Jim Stanley and his wife are the people who own this villa, and yep. and he's just assing there. You know, he himself, E.F. Benson, the author,
yeah,
he shared a villa in Capri with John Ellingham Brooks, who was, I believe, a pretty well-known gay fellow.
Yeah, openly gay. Well, as much as you could be in the...
As much as you could be around the turn of the century, yeah. Right. I mean, E.F. Benson wasn't, but the fact that he lived with Brooks...
Right.
Capri or Capri was... It was known to be a resort for wealthy gay men in the early part of the 20th century.
Right.
So maybe it's a situation like where he lived there.
He busts into ghosts very quickly,
right,
and says that usually they're not dangerous, just scary.
For most people, they leave the experience of encountering a ghost a little freaked out, but unharmed.
And then I think to myself, he's obviously never dealt with the ghost judge.
Right.
Because that dude will just straight up kill you.
Yeah, although this thing that manifests in the Villa Cascana might give the judge ghost a run for his money.
Well, I don't know. We'll talk about that later.
We'll have to decide that later, yeah.
So this place is, again, in what is called the Italian Riviera near Sestri di Levante. Boy, I hope I said that right. And I looked the place up online. It looks awesome. It's beautiful from the pictures I've seen. It's an old fishing village that has been making the change into tourist spot for a long time. And I looked up in the Ruff's travel guide to see what it says about this area. The coast east of Genoa, dubbed the Riviera di Levante, is perhaps more varied and beautiful than its counterpart to the west, but also not the place to come for a get-away-from-it-all holiday with a series of towns and villages that once eked a living from fishing and coral diving, but have been transformed by 30 years of tourism. That said, it is a glorious and rugged stretch of coast, its cliffs and bays covered with pine and olive trees, and with a number of very appealing resorts.
Oh, man, that sounds great.
You, dude, if you go look at those pictures, it made me want to go there instantly. It just looks beautiful. Our narrator is staying at the villa with this artist guy, Arthur Inglis, who's also a guest of the house of the Stanleys. The narrator is staying upstairs while Inglis is on the floor below, and then the people that actually live there are in a whole other wing.
In a whole other wing. I mean, yeah. I think like you probably did. I just had a hard time imagining this place.
Oh, yeah.
It's a big house, but I imagine it's got that, you know, Mediterranean style. I can't really get a good idea of what it looks like in my head, other than there's multiple tiers and he's staying up at the top.
When he first showed up at the house, it was a beautiful day, but the instant he stepped foot in the house, he felt something was wrong. And he thought maybe this is because he saw some letters for him sitting on the table when he arrived. And he thought, oh, maybe there's bad news in these letters. And that's what triggered this feeling. But it wasn't. It was just letters from his friends being boring, which is an amazing Pet Shop Boys song.
Yeah, it sure is. Being boring. I love that
song. It's really good.
Yeah, that whole album is good that's on.
This is a tangent, but that song is particularly amazing.
It's got a Zelda Fitzgerald reference.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And it's just about how he was a teenager and then how they were a certain way. And then when he went and moved to London and tried to make it as a musician and did successfully. But then he looks back to those times and how they all had hopes and some of them had their dreams realized and some of them didn't and some of them were dead.
Yeah.
Because it was specifically written about one of their friends that died of AIDS in the 80s. But it's just a really beautiful, thoughtful song.
I agree with you.
Has nothing to do with this story.
But, you know, you say that the letters that he got from his friends, they were all being boring. But actually what it says is my correspondence all reeked of prosperity.
Well, yeah.
So things were going well. There was nothing in those letters for him to feel bad about. But that just, to me, made me laugh that they reeked of prosperity, which can't be true. To me, it's like early social media, Facebook, everybody, everything's going great for everybody. Oh, right. You know, like he opened the envelope and all these selfies with celebrities fell out.
Yeah.
Hey, here's just some stuff for you to look at while you contemplate how your life turned out.
You know, it's funny you say that. I put up a video that my wife took of me and my kids dancing in the front room.
Mm-hmm.
And I got some really nice comments. People were saying things like, hey, you're such a great dad. And then I was immediately thinking, and I wrote this as one of the responses. I go, but my wife doesn't video record me neglecting my children and posting on Facebook.
I hope she doesn't do that. Although that would be a pretty innovative way to deal with the problem. Well, things are just going great for his friend. So that was not the reason for his sense of apprehension.
So the first night there, he didn't sleep well. He had a crazy dream, which he says, I dreamed in a very vivid and original manner. Original, that is to say, in the sense that something that, as far as I knew, had never previously entered into my consciousness, usurped it then. But looking back on the day's events, he begins to think, well, maybe some things that happened caused him to have this dream.
Right.
When he was looking around the house, he noticed an unused bedroom on the first floor, and he asked Mrs. Stanley about it because he's like, well, why didn't you put me on that floor? And then she says, oh, we left that unoccupied because Jim and I have a charming bedroom and a dressing room, as you saw in the wing. And if we used it ourselves, we should have to turn the dining room into a dressing room and have our meals downstairs. As it is, however, we have our little flat there. Arthur Inglis has that little flat in the other passage. And I remembered, aren't I extraordinary, that you once said that the higher up you were in the house, the better you were pleased. So I put you at the top of the house instead of giving you the room. So he's like, well, wait, that is way more information than I needed. So
no kidding.
Maybe she's covering something up because when people lie, they give you way too much information. So he's thinking, this seems like one of those instances.
I also like how she interrupts herself to say, aren't I extraordinary?
Yes. The second thing that happened that might have affected his dream was a topic that popped up at dinner.
Mm-hmm.
Ghosts.
Of course.
And when it came up, Inglis made fun of anyone that could possibly believe in it. I think he says, anybody who could possibly believe in the existence of supernatural phenomena was unworthy of the name of ass.
Of the name of an ass, not the name of ass.
Oh, I like my way better.
Either way, it's pretty strong. And it says the subject instantly dropped as soon as he said that, which made me feel like somebody was just about to tell a ghost story when he flew out with that. Like their mouth was open. And that's always a funny scenario when somebody assumes you're in a category and you're not. And I know I've been guilty of it before, like been in a gathering and made some political comments, just kind of assuming everyone felt the same way as me.
Yes.
But then finding out later, no, that wasn't the case. You know, you feel like such an idiot. Yeah. You made an assumption.
I'm sad to say that I have fallen into that trap as well. So those are the two things that might have affected him.
Then he goes up to bed. He was feeling tired. It was hot in his room. And when he finally got into bed, he couldn't sleep. I've been there many a time.
Yes, hate it when it's hot and you're trying to sleep. It's actually scientifically proven that it's easier to sleep when it's colder.
I believe it.
In the room. And, you know, that's why Heather and I invite Yetis into our bed whenever possible.
Does that make it colder?
Oh, yeah, it does. Then it gets hot. Aren't I extraordinary?
So he didn't toss and turn. He just kind of laid there and enjoyed the sounds of the night. He doesn't really remember falling asleep, but he thinks he must have because what happens next is pretty nutty. Since he can't sleep, he decides he's going to read, but he remembered he left his book downstairs. So he gets the candle, lights it, goes down. And when he reaches the first floor, he notices that the door to that room that nobody's staying in is open and there's a gray light coming out of it. Not moonlight, but something else. So he takes a peek inside.
The bed stood just opposite the door. A big four-poster hung with tapestry at the head. Then I saw that the grayish light of the bedroom came from the bed, or rather, from what was on the bed, for it was covered with great caterpillars, a foot or more in length, which crawled over it. They were faintly luminous, and it was the light from them that showed me the room. Instead of the sucker feet of ordinary caterpillars, they had rows of pincers like crabs, and they moved by grasping what they lay on with their pincers, and then sliding their bodies forward. In color, these dreadful insects were yellowish-gray, and they were covered with irregular lumps and swellings. There must have been hundreds of them, for they formed a sort of writhing, crawling pyramid on the bed, Occasionally, one fell off onto the floor with a soft, fleshy thud. And though the floor was of hard concrete, it yielded to the pincer feet as if it had been putty, and crawling back, the caterpillar would mount onto the bed again to rejoin its fearful companions. They appeared to have no faces, so to speak, but at one end of them there was a mouth that opened sideways in respiration. Then, as I looked, it seemed to me as if they all suddenly became conscious of my presence.
Dude, what the f***? That is some crazy stuff.
Yeah.
What is going on?
I don't know. And it's supposed to be a ghost manifestation of some kind?
Yeah, what kind of ghost is that? That's not a ghost.
I don't know.
That's a bunch of freaking giant caterpillars with crab feet.
It's so creepy and disgusting. And when one falls to the floor, it's with a soft, fleshy thud.
Thud.
Abhorrent. Insects should not make noise that you can hear when they hit the ground or anything.
And then it crawls back up on the bed on this big pile of bugs. They're all crawling all over each other.
Yeah, yeah. And it's strong enough that it can grab onto concrete with those pincher feet.
Yeah.
Which the floor is made of. It says they don't have faces, but all their mouths were turned in his direction. That's how he knew they were attentive to him. Gah!
All of them, they just look at the narrator and then slowly they start to drop off the bed and crawl towards him. Mm. At first he's paralyzed with fear, which I understand that.
Sure.
But then he's gone like a flash right up to his room, slams the door behind him. He knows he was awake at this point because he couldn't go back to sleep. He thought to himself, if those things come up here, they're going to just be able to pinch right through the door. I mean, they're cutting into concrete.
Yeah.
This wood door is going to be nothing to them.
The story is really interesting because it's set up as a ghost story, but these are physical creatures. And they're kind of non-spectacular. They're gross, but they're not a big ghostly woman in the room or something like that. You know,
it's
they're bugs.
Yeah.
I mean, you really could, for some weird reason, have a mass of caterpillars invade your home. I'm sure stranger things have happened.
Right.
And then the effect that they produce, which we'll get to in a bit, is pretty real life as well.
Yeah, but I don't think that these things are actually physical.
I don't think so either.
There's some kind of manifestation of something, but of what, I have no idea. Again, let's talk about this at the end of the story.
Well, yeah, let's get into the next scene then.
So dawn approached. He felt his fears slip away as the sky became blue. Mm-hmm. He kind of goes, you know, it must have been a dream because that doesn't make any sense what I saw. He hangs out on his own in the morning, but meets up with the other three folks for lunch. Ingalls points out this little pillbox and tells the narrator, hey, take a look inside. He opens it and he finds a caterpillar inside that looks just like the one he saw before, but much smaller. And he sees it's even got those little crab pincer feet, just like the other ones had. And he closes the box really fast and he asks Ingalls what he's going to do with it. And Ingalls says, oh, you know, it's a new discovery. I'll take it back to some of my scientist buddies and maybe I'll have it called Cancer Inglesensis?
Inglesensis, I think.
Inglesensis?
I don't know. I kept reading it. Every time I saw the word, I read it as Iglesias.
Yeah.
Like Julio Iglesias or his son Enrique. I thought, boy, Cancer Iglesias. He's the other son. He just can't seem to get his career off the ground for some reason. Ladies and gentlemen, Cancer Iglesias. They call the creature that because cancer is the Latin for crab.
Right.
The caterpillar's got those crab-like pinchers. And that's the reason they want to call it cancer. Ugh.
And the narrator just has one of those moments where your body takes over and your mind has no control over what you're doing. And he just picks up the box and hurls it out the window into the fountain below.
Right.
And Inglis, he just laughs at this and says, what was up with that? And then he says this, which I don't quite understand. He says, so the students of the occult don't like solid facts. My poor caterpillar. Students of the occult?
I don't know what he's talking about. I mean, clearly our narrator is some kind of
occult guy. That's the first we hear of it and kind of the last we hear of it as well.
Yeah.
He doesn't bring it up again.
It's weird. And also, if he knows that, then him shutting down ghosts at dinner has a little more import to it. He was making fun of his friend.
Right.
If he clearly knows that, he believes in that stuff. This whole thing seemed pretty rude, actually. And I just would rather in this scene that there was more of the, what did you do that for?
Right.
Because he got it, he caught that little cool insect he thought might be really rare.
Yeah.
And his buddy just grabbed it and threw it.
Well, it just freaked him out so much that he did that.
Yeah.
And it makes that whole dream thing that he saw before feel way more real because obviously he never saw that creature before. And then.
Right. So it is an actual creature.
Well, yeah, sort of.
I mean, I know this is a smaller version of what he saw on the bed. By the way, so those were like big caterpillars?
Yeah, they were a foot long.
Oh, God.
He hangs out the afternoon, but later he goes by the fountain and he sees the pillbox is dissolved in the fountain. But the caterpillar has somehow managed to escape and climbed up the Cupid statue that's at the center.
crazy.
As he looked at it, it seemed to look at him mm-hmm. again, you know, kind of turned its way. It crawls down the statue. It swims
right
like a snake across the water, comes out of the fountain, starts to crawl towards him. And just then, English shows up.
That is some creepy stuff for an insect to actively have an interest in.
Yeah, and swim.
Uh-huh.
Oh, ooh. The caterpillar stops, looks at the narrator, and then Inglis, and then back and forth until finally moving towards Inglis. And then he says, "It likes me best, but I don't really know that I like it. And as it won't drown, I think perhaps," and then he just steps on it.
Right. Well, he shakes it because it actually had gone far enough to crawl onto his shoe.
Right.
I mean, it definitely chose him.
Yeah.
But then he shakes it off and kills it. So it's like this caterpillar had to choose between these three men to smell a reality show.
So that night he goes to bed, falls asleep or not, again, not sure,
mm-hmm.
lies there for a while before he decides that he's going to get up. He walks out onto the landing and sees a horrific sight.
The whole of the landing of the first floor below was invisible under the swarm of caterpillars that crawled there. The folding doors into the sitting room from which opened the bedroom which I had seen them last night were shut, but they were squeezing through the cracks of it and dropping one by one through the keyhole, elongating themselves into mere string as they passed, and growing fat and lumpy again on emerging. Some, as if exploring, were nosing about the steps into the passage, at the end of which were Inglis's rooms. Others were crawling on the lowest steps of the staircase that led up to where I stood. The landing, however, was completely covered with them. I was cut off. And of the frozen horror that seized me when I saw that, I can give no idea in words.
Reminded me of playing Piranha as a kid, you know?
What?
When you'd say the whole floor is a piranha. You can't go, can't touch the floor, so you'd have to...
We did Hot Lava.
Hot Lava, that's what it was? You know, you had to climb around on the couches and chairs, and anybody who touched the floor.
Yeah.
You could do it with caterpillars.
Evil footlong caterpillars.
They're so gross. They're fat and lumpy when they come out of the door.
Yeah, it's pretty horrific stuff. They all start to move in a wave of caterpillars towards Inglis's bedroom door.
Right. It says, like some hideous tide of flesh.
Ugh.
With a pale, great luminousness coming from them. You know, you said they were about a foot long. That's a little like those glow worms. Do you remember those?
Oh, the toys that you fill up with, and you give them a hug and they glow.
Right. It was like a little worm body,
and
it had a little smiley head that would glow.
I think it had like a little nightcap, you know, like
mm-hmm.
Hat. Yeah.
So it would go to bed with you.
Did you have one of those?
No, I never had one, but I'm glad I didn't because apparently they were based on the story.
Apparently. the narrator tries to shout a warning to him, but he doesn't seem to be heard. All of the caterpillars pour into Inglis's room, and then they're just gone.
Right.
The narrator just stands there, and he realizes that the sky is becoming blue, and dawn is approaching, and then his feet are cold, and he kind of goes, wait, am I sleepwalking? Did that really happen, you know?
Mm-hmm.
This is how the actual story ends.
6 months after I met Mrs. Stanley in a country house in England, we talked on many subjects, and at last she said, I don't think I've seen you since I got that dreadful news about Arthur Inglis a month ago. I haven't heard, said I. No, he has got cancer. They don't even advise an operation, for there is no hope of a cure. He is riddled with it, the doctors say. Now, during all these 6 months, I do not think a day had passed on which I had not had in my mind the dreams, or whatever you like to call them, which I had seen in the Via Cascana. It is awful, is it not? She continued. And I feel I can't help feeling that he may have caught it at the Via, I asked. She looked at me in blank surprise. What did you say? She asked. How did you know? Then she told me. In the unoccupied bedroom a year before, there had been a fatal case of cancer. She had, of course, taken the best advice, and had been told that the utmost dictates of prudence would be obeyed, so long as she did not put anybody to sleep in the room, which had also been thoroughly disinfected and newly whitewashed and painted. But...
And that's it. It ends mid-sentence.
Yeah, that's it. But, dash, what? Over.
Over. End of the story.
I mean, I think the point being, they disinfected this room and whitewashed and painted it, but... The cancer still got out.
It got out. What the hell is this story about?
It's hard to say.
It's crazy, man.
Yeah.
Back to about the judge. The caterpillars can't give the ghost cancer.
Say what?
The judge.
Yes.
The judge's house.
Oh, you're saying if it were the caterpillars versus the judge?
Yeah.
Oh, the judge would win.
He'd totally win.
But with the judge, I was surprised because that ghost could just up and hang you.
Yeah.
But here I'm surprised because the ghostly manifestation are worms that give you cancer.
Gives you cancer?
This is another thing I did not know ghosts could do.
I would argue that they're not ghosts. I mean, a ghost usually means the soul of a departed person.
Mm-hmm.
So this is something else entirely. This is some kind of interdimensional being or spirit entity or demon, possibly.
Recently, they announced, the White House administration, that they wanted to attack cancer the way that they attacked, you know, putting a man on the moon. They want a cure for cancer to be the next moonshot that the United States has. They're putting a couple of years on it. You know, we're gonna solve this thing, and they put Joe Biden in charge of it. He's kind of the cancer czar. But I thought it would be funny if Joe Biden showed up with this story. Guys, I read this last night. Solved it. We got to find these caterpillars. We got to stomp them out. Done.
What is going on with the story?
I don't know.
Why is there like little ones that are real, and then there's like the spectral ones that are like a foot long?
I have no idea. But you know, you can't catch cancer.
No, of course not.
The way they talk about it here.
No. I mean, obviously, this story was written a long time ago, and they didn't really have an understanding.
Well, when was it?
Oh, it was in a 1912 collection. It was called the Room in the Tower.
So there were probably some misconceptions about that. Although I think cancer research was developed enough that they understood these were aberrant cells.
Right.
But that's what the whole thing is about. So I think that part of the story, if you look at it as a kind of supernatural look at getting this disease, I mean, certainly cancer is a horrifying and very mysterious disease.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of randomness to it, right?
Yeah.
There's some behaviors that we know have a positive correlation. I think 20% of cancers, they think, are caused by tobacco use. You know, another 10% are due to alcohol use or obesity,
mm-hmm.
Being sedentary, not having a very active lifestyle, having a poor diet. But after that, it really is, there's some genetics involved, but it's kind of a random thing that happens. And there's the scene in this story where the caterpillar seems to be fixated on our narrator.
Mm-hmm.
It swims out of the fountain towards him. But then when the artist shows up, there's a quick little moment where, I mean, I was joking, but the caterpillar really does kind of look at all three of them and then go, I'll go to this guy.
Yeah.
And it crawls onto his shoe, and then he's the one that gets the cancer. But if he hadn't showed up, it could have been the narrator.
Yeah.
It's this randomness. And, you know, when you do get this disease, that one, of course, one of the first questions that people ask is, why did this happen to me? Especially if you weren't involved in any of those behaviors, which I said, you know, correlate to the
sure.
cancer. It's this horrifying question you have to ask, and the terrible realization you have to confront that some of these things are just random, and there's good luck and bad luck, and some people treat themselves awfully and live till they're 90 and never have any of these problems at all.
Yeah,
it made me think a lot about, well, you know, my sister had cancer when we were teenagers.
Uh-huh.
She went through 2.5 years of chemotherapy and radiation to treat leukemia. She survived it and is perfectly healthy now. We talked about it not that long ago. When I first started writing horror, she said to me, you know, actually, if I was ever going to make a movie or anything about my experience, it would be a horror movie. Not a drama or anything sappy,
mm-hmm.
because the experience itself goes that way. You know, first your body's going through changes you don't understand. She was having fainting spells, seeing colors, having weird thoughts, not knowing why. And then once you're diagnosed, you're confronted with your mortality, which is obviously horrifying.
Sure.
And then there's the element of body horror, you know, all the needles, the bone marrow extractions and the spinal taps and the uncertainty, all of these things. And then also the fact that you're doing battle with this insidious thing that you can't see. You know, the temptation mm-hmm. would be to kind of manifest it as something, you know, that you're fighting. I know that people don't necessarily like doing battle with cancer, you know, as a description of it, you know, because it makes it seem like people who die of cancer, like,
oh right, yeah,
they lost the,
yeah,
like they weren't good enough at their battle, you know,
their kung fu wasn't strong enough, and they
right, which is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I don't know if E.F. Benson had friends that were dealing with this disease. The eerie thing is that a couple of decades later, he died of throat cancer himself.
So maybe he did know people that had cancer. This is what that is about.
Yeah, it could be. By the way, we were talking about glowworms a second ago, just looking it up on Wikipedia during this discussion. The original toy upon release was such a success that Hasbro released a series of storybooks, nightlights, videos, and other merchandise. It continued until the early 1990s. However, in late 2005, the product was criticized for harming children. Its plastic head was softened with phthalates, which can be dangerous if swallowed by children.
Oh.
So this glowworm in the modern age was dangerous, too, and sowing disease.
Wow. That's pretty horrific. Well, cool story. Really freaked me out. Good job, E.F. Benson.
Agreed. Jumping back from all of the actual cancer stuff, I mean, I just think in terms of it being a weird story, it's pretty darn effective.
Yeah.
It's hard to say why any of this happens.
It's really crazy and awesome and creepy and good job.
Yes, exists in a world of its own. So next week and next month, we're going to flip things up a little bit.
Yeah, we are. And normally we've been given February to werewolves and talking about the history of werewolves in literature.
Now, just a word about that. We Werewolf History Month is what we called it. That is not a knock on Black History Month,
no.
Which is actually what February is.
Yes.
Black History Month, where we should have been reading Black literature, which we would have gladly done had we known of any of it existing in this specific genre. Without having that, we tongue-in-cheek kind of did Werewolf History Month.
Exactly. But now that we're older and wiser and we've had some feedback from some wonderful listeners, we've managed to find a couple, and only a couple, but one of them is a novel called Of One Blood by Pauline Hopkins, who's not just a Black person, she is a woman.
This novel that she wrote, Of One Blood, which has all kinds of, I think, ghosts and spirits and weirdness in it.
Dude, yeah, I think it's got some Reanimator kind of stuff in there.
Right, and it's early 20th century. It's right in line with all the other stuff that we cover. I'm so excited about that. So next week and for the month of February, it might take us all month to do actually that.
Yeah, we're not sure how long because it's pretty long, but we might be able to get through it depending on how concise it is and how much actually happens.
One way or the other, we've got enough stuff to do February this time as Black History Month.
Actual Black Literary History Month for us.
On the H.P. Lovecraft Show.
Eat that, Lovecraft.
Well, so next week we're going to start in on Of One Blood by Pauline Hopkins.
Yep.
There's a PDF online you can read, so we'll link out to that.
Yeah, the PDF, unfortunately, is of a scan. I'm going through trying to make a nice document of it for our show, and if I do get done with it and stick with it, I will we'll post that so people can have access to it in a nice text-friendly format.
Oh, that's awful kind of you.
Yeah.
All right. Well, next week we'll be talking about that. This has been a fun month of haunted houses. I want to thank our reader once again, Jeff C. Carter. Go check out his Kickstarter and the Mecha West project. It looks pretty cool.
Yeah, I can't wait to back that thing. And with that, I'm Chris Lackey.
I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hppodcraft.com.
But when I looked down at my leg, I saw a giant caterpillar writhing there. And I said, what a twist.
hppodcraft.com.